Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
If I knew now what I knew then, I would have done a different journey.
And the Grammy goes to
dance album,
DJ of the year,
Diplo.
And I just remember I did this whole circuit working with all these young rappers, and they were like really young. They were like 19, 20. And these rappers all started to die. You know, Lil Peep overdosed, X was shot. Nobody really cares about like all the adoration you get. You care about the people that don't like you. And that you get caught up in that. It's not a consistent paycheck. Music never is. And it wasn't for me for 3-4 years. 1 month I'm not doing good. I can't pay rent. I'm homeless.
What's the sacrifice or the cost in terms of like personal life balance?
I have to answer that?
Wes.
Yeah.
Whenever I do this podcast, I always get really intrigued by the formative years of someone's life. And in your story, it seemed like a very, very humble beginning. When I look at where you started under the age of 14, I couldn't quite piece together myself, obviously, how that early upbringing had led you to becoming who you are today. Is there anything when from below the age of, say, like 14, that you can point at and say, if that hadn't have happened, or if I hadn't had that experience or that interaction with a family member or a grandfather, whatever it might be, I don't think I would be here today.
I didn't start really producing, releasing music till like my mid-20s because it was pretty late. I was doing things, but not actually at a level where I could quit my job and it's my main source of income. But when I was younger, I was a pretty bad kid. I was bouncing from high schools and different middle schools. And I was actually sent to a military school at one point at like that age, like 14. And I even got expelled from there. And then like, that was like my last shot. Right. And I came back, they let me back in cause it cost my family like a lot of money. It was like $3,000 for me to go there because I was getting sent out of every school, but going to the military school, maybe if anything, it taught me how to like, if I was going to do something criminal or like something bad, like it was bad, be a little smarter about it. If anything, cause everybody there was like criminal. The whole military school was just a bunch of terrible kids and they were like really knew what they were doing. So if anything, I kind of like, it was like learning from the school of hard knocks, you know? Mm. But I think being in military school, even that was only like for 1 year, and my father, he was a Vietnam vet. And, you know, I think I can attribute his concept of discipline to it. You know, like no matter how bad I was and how much I disagree with my father, he gave me the most complex rules of what discipline means, what it is to apply in whatever you're doing. And I didn't realize that until I was older that, you know, all these, what makes my story successful, like what makes me a better DJ or what makes me a better songwriter. It really, I don't have the technical abilities, but I always apply myself to find a goal, you know? And I really feel like that's what my father gave me before I turned into an adult. Cause it's just something I like had inside me that separated me from everybody else when I got into the music business.
Work ethic was such a clear thread throughout your story, like relentless, almost at times it seemed somewhat obsessive work ethic. And it's funny because when I hear about your early upbringing, I guess my assumption is because it sounds quite similar to mine, getting kicked out of school and being the only kid out of four siblings that was like always getting bad grades, always in exclusion. Did people around you think you were going nowhere at that point?
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, even till the mid-20s, my father was like, how did you buy this house? Like, what are you doing? Like, there's no way possibly you're making money with music. Like, it's like, there's just no possible way. And I went to college. I went to UCF, like a little community college, because I couldn't afford like a real school. I did 2 years there, just being in a school so that I could have something to advance forward. And then I went to Temple University in Philly, and I ended up dropping out of that school, but I went for anthropology and filmmaking. So it was like a really two other degrees that would literally turn into no job. But I was obsessed with documentary filmmaking. I thought that would be something I could do. I was obsessed with culture. I was obsessed with humans and people and the study of culture. And when I was a young person, I was reading National Geographic all the time and watching documentaries. So that was something, I was like, how do I apply that, you know? And my father was also like, this is a huge mistake. What are you doing? What about accounting? That's a great degree to have. In the end, I think what I'd learned at that university was, because in the film program, it was like, there was a lot of creative avenues I could learn from. And the people who were professors were almost like filmmakers that didn't make it. And they have to be professors, it kind of feels like. So I was like, what am I doing here? I don't want to learn. These people aren't even in the business, you know? So the real business is like going out and making it yourself. And I think I just did that set third year. I was like, I'm out of school. But I kind of wish I had dropped out of college earlier and had a head start, because it took you a while when you're paying your college tuition and working, and it's so time consuming. And then eventually I started to do music and do little odd jobs like DJing, to where I was like, oh, I can kind of like quit my jobs now. And also, like, yeah, I think if I knew now what I knew then, I would have done a different journey. But I think that's what makes you who you are, you know, no matter how long it takes.
And eventually you make that decision to sort of start heading towards music, right? Even though it's not paying you at all. And I was reading about the jobs you were doing in that period of your life. You worked at a zoo at one point.
Yeah.
You were a social worker at one point.
Yeah.
How long did that period of your life, when you'd made the decision to move towards music and that music was going to be your thing, how long was that?
It definitely wasn't. I mean, at 22 years old, I was already working like 9 to 5s. You know, it was like the social work job was my first job, as like, this is a job that feels good to do. Like, you know, I'm working with children. I was going between teaching kids and then after school program. And it just felt like, okay, this is cool. It feels like I'm doing something for somebody instead of working at like Subway and making money for the head of Subway, which is kind of like a waste of my energy. But working with kids, I felt a little bit like I felt fulfilled, you know? I think, but then you run into the bureaucracy of I was in a city like Philadelphia. So it was just like so much corruption, even in like the social work world. It was crazy. Eventually I was getting beaten down at that job too. I was like, this is my life. Like 22. I'm like, this is all I can look forward to, is like building my way into like this job or this job. And I think I started DJing on the side, at parties and learning from the DJs there. Cause Philadelphia is a famous city for DJing. It's like culturally one of the most important cities in America, for hip hop, for DJing. And I just started doing parties, and then I saw what you do if you do your own party. Like, you can invest in yourself and promote a party, and then you take everything, right? So I started learning small little business acumen from just doing parties. And then eventually I started, I can quit my job. I can make it. It was a huge step, because at that point you don't know, when you're doing music and parties full time, it's literally up to how much you're working or what you're doing to keep the money flowing to pay the rent. If I don't, one month I'm not doing good, I can't pay rent. I'm homeless. It's not a consistent paycheck. Music never is. And it wasn't for me for probably 3-4 years. But yeah, it's just literally putting your boots to the ground and like doing the work and like failing at it and learning what makes you better, what makes you more money. Like, how do you grow this business? Even in these little small steps, that's kind of what I did in those first years of my career. And I wasn't even really making my own music yet. I was just DJing and making mixtapes and making edits and learning how to use computers still. Like, I had nobody to teach me. I was buying hardware, or, you know, in high school, shoplifting from Sam Goody and Sam Ash and like Guitar Center, like samplers to use. So it really just came down to just the grind to figure out what works and what doesn't.
It was so evident, even when I was hearing about you, like in the record stores and ultimately selling a record to are they vinyls you were selling to Canyon samples and stuff? But throughout that, even like the story about you reading, was it William Faulkner's book?
Yeah.
And you had this clear hunger for learning. Teaching yourself how to make music, teaching yourself computers, teaching yourself the business side of things. Most people don't have a predisposition just to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
And that, again, when I'm trying to figure out exactly how you became this global superstar, I'm like, that feels to be a consistent thread throughout your story as well, that learning hunger.
I think when you think about what a DJ is, you know, now they're like David Guetta, they're headlining festivals, or even me, like I'm headlining my own shows. But back when I was growing up, you know, the big DJs from, say, Detroit, like The Magician, or like, you know, Afro Bambaataa, people that were DJs were like the selectors. They were like the guys who did all the work to know what music is there, what this music is, how this music exists. And they were like kind of the cultural benchmark. They were the guys who cataloged everything to distribute in the scene, right? So I think I loved that. Like, I was like, I love music. Like, I love what it is. And I went to parties and I remember seeing people like Questlove and like Cash Money and these DJs like Cosmo Baker playing crazy records, like playing Fela Kuti and then playing like you know, a disco record and then playing something new, like a local hip hop record. And I was like, and then they're playing like Babe Ruth, like an old rock and roll record. I was so obsessed with how they could connect these things that don't make any sense musically. And that's what I always thought was the great, I think, story of what DJs do, is they're like guys who can process all this culture and give it to you in a certain way. And now it's more streamlined. You're going to go to a house party, hear house music. You're going to go to like a bashment party, hear dance hall. But the really special DJs were able to like do everything. And so I think when I learned that was like a skill set, I started looking at vinyl. I started learning about different music. I would like ask DJs, what is that record you're playing? Who are these artists? Like, what is Fela Kuti? Where's Nigeria? Where do they make music? Like, what's it sound like? You know, then I'm like, where are the producers? Like, the guy from The Who went to Nigeria and was a drummer there. And then he went back and did this. And then, James Brown heard this guy. And then he hired another drummer. This is like, became like a web of music. I started to follow everything and read liner notes. And then I just was obsessed with gaining all the knowledge about music, whatever I could, and using that to apply to being a DJ. That obsession just led me to being a record collector. You know, like I said, I traveled a little bit. At the end of my university, I went to India with one of my professors to work on a documentary and the border of Pakistan and India. It's called in Gujarat. It was like this little kind of like a valley called the Round of Kutch. There was a huge earthquake there, I think around 2000. And I was there doing some sort of building work and, you know, working with Red Cross and things like that. And then I just kind of bounced and took a motorcycle and just went all over India and just explored my own. And I bought a bunch of vinyl. At the time, the most expensive record in the world were these Beatles 78s. They were like Beatles records, but at 78 RPM.
Right.
If you find good ones in India, they only make them in India. If you find good ones, they're worth like $1,000 to a couple thousand dollars. But I was finding Indian soundtracks. I was finding things like, there's a classic Indian soundtrack called Shalimar with like crazy like spy themes and like break beats on it. At the time, if you find one of those at a record shop, pay like a couple of rupees, you could bring it back to London and sell it at like Poland Street for like, you know, £300. Ooh. So that was like this weird hack I found, like traveling and buying records. I did it in India, I did it in Philadelphia, I would go to New Jersey, I go to New York, and I would buy old records and sell it to different record collectors, you know? Nick Questlove was one of my first guys I sold to. I sold records to Kanye West when he first started producing. Collecting records was like a certain business. And then on eBay, that was another hustle I had, like selling things that I buy flea market stuff and sell it on eBay. A lot of it was vinyl.
Correct. One of the things again, that's so obvious and apparent with you, which is kind of a thread that kind of weaves between many of my guests, specifically comedians for some reason, because comedians, they at some point you see this decision they've made to like leave the city, leave like their job in finance and pursue this thing that has no apparent chance of making them any money at all. Mm-hmm. But they just follow this like passionate obsession. They spend a year going up and down the country working for nothing because they're obsessed with comedy for whatever reason. And a lot of young people, when they think about being a DJ or an entrepreneur or whatever, they think to themselves, okay, I want the admiration of standing there and all these people clapping for me and the money.
Yeah.
But you were so clearly led by this like unbelievably obsessive passion, which seems actually to be, if I was to say 95% of my guests followed one path, it would definitely be they didn't really care about the outcome. They cared about like the passion and the pursuit of the passion.
Yeah.
That's so clear with you, right?
I mean, in the beginning, it was definitely a hustle. Like I love music and it saved me from, you know, even in high school, I moved from different high school to high school and I didn't have a friend group. So I kind of was like leaning towards, I want to play music, but I couldn't. My parents didn't even buy me a guitar. Like I didn't even know how to play. I was like, well, how am I going to learn a guitar? Or, you know, how am I going to learn piano? But I like was like DJing. That's like the future of music. Like it was like turntablism was really big. I remember being like 16, being like, I'm gonna buy record players. That's what I'm gonna buy. That's what I'm gonna do as a creative person. This is like a futuristic way to do things. So I leaned into that, started learning what a DJ was. But in the beginning, I had to do the groundwork to know what it is I'm gonna play, like what it is that the music comes from. Where was this music at? Where do I buy the records? What do the crowds react to? Et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, this formative years, I spent time grinding, but then eventually I was like, okay, how do I make money out of this? And yes, I want to play for a crowd. And yes, I want adoration. Yes, I want to meet girls. Of course, that happens later and that's another drive. But in the beginning, I didn't really expect to have a job out of it, you know?
Do you think you would have been as successful as you are if someone had taught you how to make music and you'd been really mentored by someone? Because sometimes that hurts innovation and creativity if convention is too involved.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean?
I do what you mean, because I see nowadays like kids can literally learn and copy any style of music in a day because they have a tutorial. It's so easy. Yeah. It's really easy. And I wish I had that. But then at the same time, I wouldn't have had such a definitive like who I am. And if I were, people always ask me when I do radio shows, like, what advice do you give to young DJs? And it's like always the same thing. Like, what makes yourself unique? Like, what really makes you different? Because I could throw a fucking rock and I'm going to hit a DJ or artist in the head in London. Like, I'm just somebody here. It's like, somebody, not talking about you, but, yeah, I'm like, but it's so easy. Like, I literally get demos all the time. Like, what? I don't even care. I don't even pay attention. I used to actually like try to listen to demos. I'm like, this is all the same shit. Like, people are doing the same thing over and over again. Like, you know, whatever city you're in, there's like a thing. And every once in a while you get like a special person that comes out of nowhere and you're like, wow, that's unique. Mm. Like, but really what is it? Like, for me, you were talking about William Faulkner. I really tapped into like my Southern heritage when I was younger. I was like, what? I loved like Miami bass music growing up in Florida. I loved like, you know, the crunk scene, the bounce scene in New Orleans. I grew up in Tennessee for a couple of years. So I loved like Memphis rap. It was like my favorite thing. So when I went to the East Coast, none of that stuff was happening. Like, nobody listened to that music. So I was like, let me bring this to the East Coast. Let me start playing this at my parties. And it took off. Like, all this new sounds I brought, even though they're just like a 1 hour flight down south to hear Miami bass music, no one listened to it in Philly. So I was playing this stuff mixed with like 80s records. And that was like my brand. I was the guy that was like doing this mashup culture. And so nobody else had that party. There was like urban parties and be playing hip hop. There would be, you know, rock and roll parties playing like glam rock and you could dance to it. There would be like high-end parties playing house music, but nobody was playing for like the art school kids and the hipsters at the time, because it was pre-hipster. It wasn't even a word yet. And I was like, that's my market. And I was like, no one's tapped into this. Let me go ahead and do this. You know, and every little venture I've done as a musician has been like, why is no one in this market? Like, even when I did Major Lazer, it was like reggae and dancehall we were doing, but nobody was really doing it in the clubs in America. There was like, if you go to like Philly, you want to see Vibes Cartel, you have to go to like this one ghetto club in like Lancaster, and it's like only Jamaicans there. And I'm like, this is such crazy music. Like, why don't we do this on another level? Like, why don't we work with some of these artists and do bigger records? And so I was like, no one's doing dancehall. Let's do it, this project. So everywhere I went, I was like experimenting. Like, how do I do this and kind of make it my own? Or how do I like work this into my sets? And it's been like a journey, you know. This is 20 years now I'm doing this since I played at my first show at Fabric. And it feels like I've done so many. If you're a fan of mine and you follow me for 20 years, it's a really tough journey. Because it's like I've done, you're going to go to reggae music, you're going to go to country music, now you're going to go to deep house, you're going to go this way and this way. But a few people actually go with me and follow my career. So, you know, I think that's what makes me a one-of-a-kind person, I guess. So back to my point, when young people ask me questions of like, what is it to, what kind of advice I can give you? I'm like, what? Find like a really unique thing and just lean into that. Lean into that so hard. Like, figure out, even if it feels weird, just make it make sense. You know, make it work for you, because otherwise you're just going to be one of 100, like clones of different DJs, different rappers.
If it feels weird, is that sometimes also an indication that there's a big opportunity there, because it's yet to break or it's yet to be discovered? So like, weirdness might be a
100%.
Yeah.
More now than ever. Back then it was like, I mean, even DJs wasn't a thing when I started doing it. Like, being a DJ wasn't a career. It was like, there's a few guys on the radio. In Europe is different. There was a DJ culture here, but in America, there wasn't like a job description called DJ. Like, you wouldn't think, there wasn't DJs on the radio. They weren't featuring on their music. Now it's pretty commonplace, but just being a DJ was unique for me. But nowadays, since there's so much information all the time, so much media, there's so much artists fighting for your eyeballs and your ears on TikTok and Instagram. It's more than ever important to have something like, wow, I gotta go look at that again, because it's like, just having a catchy hook's not enough. Everybody has a cat, like, there's a thousand catchy hooks, you can just go and buy them literally at the market. It's like not special.
One thing that really surprised me about you as well is that you're quite I don't know whether the word is humble about your talent, but when I've seen in multiple interviews, when you're asked what the biggest misconception is about you, one of them you said is that I'm talented. And I've heard you say a number of times that you're faking it, or that you're still looking for some kind of like validation that you're a real, you know. And even at the start of this conversation, you said, I'm not technically the best. Or,
yeah.
Where is that imposter syndrome? What is that?
No, I think I've always been like more of a conceptual artist. Like, you know, I think of music in concepts. I think of music as like, oh, it's like a math problem, you know, like, how does this add to this? How do I make it work? You know, it's always been like a riddle every time I try to think of like what to combine things. Now it's a little easier because I'm like, oh, I'm doing this kind of dance album and I know exactly what works because I'm DJing these records and I'm making, you know, collaborations with friends of mine and artists. But when I was younger, I literally, my first album was called Florida. It was on Ninja Tune. And it's so weird. Like, I remember being just like so stoned and just fucked up and like making this record and like people still hit me back like, that record was a classic. I'm like, what are you talking about? It was like crazy chaos. It was like me just like in my room in Orlando, like trying to figure out how to, I wasn't even, things weren't even in key. Like I'm sampling on this like two channel little like Akai S20 sampler. Like the thing worked, and laying things out. Like if you know anything about DAWs, like workstations, like they're so complex, like Logic, Ableton. Back then I used something called Cool Edit Pro, and there wasn't even like a piano roll or anything. I just had like Windows, like Photoshop, when you just like, I just layered the loops on top of each other and sequenced it in one long window because I couldn't, it was the worst way to work ever. But I learned this ass backwards way that kind of gave me a little flavor, I guess. But I never was like a musician, you know, like I never mastered an instrument. And I always thought DJing, I never was a good turntablist. Like, I mean, if you put me in my room with like A-Track or like DJ Craze, it's embarrassing. Those guys are like, they're like magicians, you know? But I thought, I'm the guy with like ideas, and how do I apply those ideas? And it became easy as the technology advanced. Like I'm like, oh, these programs make it a lot easier for me. I don't need to like play my MIDI keyboard. I don't need to be Scott Storch. You know, I can just like literally see the audio. Ableton's my favorite because I see audio and I can work with raw audio. It's my mind works that way. So I think, yeah, I'm more of a conceptual person than I am like a digital auteur. Even with production, I mean, I always say like Skrillex is like the guy that blew my mind. Like he uses like a computer, like a grand piano. Like he just does, it's the craziest thing he does, you know? So I think there's people that are in my generation that are like the savants, and I'm not that, but I kind of mixed my talent for new sounds and a talent for songwriting to make what, like who I am.
But to say that you're faking it, and to, I mean, maybe it was a joke, but yeah, to describe it as, the biggest misconception.
It might have been talking about DJing, because I mean, literally, it's probably like the most. It's people will ask me like how to do it or what to do it. It's such a, you can learn it in 10 minutes, like how to do the technical sides. You know, was I faking that? I mean, no, because at the end of the day, what I think makes DJ special, what I explained earlier, is that you have to have history. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it special. I think it's why you have DJ careers in London, especially. These guys are like David Rodigan. You know, he's like a guy who's like in his like late 60s. I hope I don't age him, maybe 70s. But he's been doing this since he was interviewing Bob Marley. Like he still rocks parties, playing like selecting the perfect records because he has the skill set. Like he knows exactly, he can read a crowd in like Southwest London. He can go to Jamaica. He can go to like Italy and he can play the right songs at the right time. So there's something intrinsically beautiful about, you know, being a DJ. But yeah, some things it feels like I'm faking it. But I mean, even in the beginning, I faked it to like get in the studio. You know, that's what I did to have my foot in the door, you know?
When you are asked about your creative process, I was looking through the huge wealth of traveling that you've done. Brazil, India, spent time in London and various parts of the world. How formative is travel and going to these different cultures and understanding the way they do things to what the art you ultimately created? Because when I think about creativity from a marketing standpoint, I see it as like pulling together lots of little pieces to form something new. And you have, because of your obsession with the vinyls and the musics and the samples, you seem to have this like huge wealth of like artistic reference points to create new stuff from.
I'm just obsessed with the conversation that's like happening all over the world. Like, you know, whether I go to Brazil or you know, London's a good example where you have this like Pan-African, Jamaican, Caribbean, and then like, you know, European thing happening that's like drum and bass, that's like funky, that's like, now it's drill. Like there's all these genres that if you look into it, why it exists, you can literally pinpoint the first creators and like where they come from and like, why is it like, why do they make this kind of sound? So I was always like putting together the equations, like why are these things happening? And Brazil's one of my favorite places to talk about because I was hearing this music, it was called Funk Carioca for a long time. There's girls that were doing a party in Philly, and I remember they gave me a mixtape, and it was this like sound that was a mix of Miami bass and samba and like heavy metal because they're screaming songs. There's bass beats, but they're using like these tamborzinho like drums. Yeah, so I was like, "What the fuck is this?" I like literally couldn't find any information on this music. So I went to Brazil, and I actually had a magazine fund this trip. It was an article for Fader magazine, and I went down there. I met the big DJs and I just became immersed in that scene, you know, producing with some of those guys, learning to produce with them and moving that sound forward a little bit. I think my first real production was with MIA. It was called Bucky Dungun. And it was a funk record that we did. And remember, we actually went back to Brazil and played it at this huge festival. And it was like a massive hit in Brazil and actually helped, I think, maybe validate some of the funk music in Brazil, because before that it was like a Rio thing and it became like a all over the country they started making. And now if you go to Brazil, like funk music is the most commercial thing. Back then, 20 years ago, it was like a pretty underground genre. And but yeah, everywhere I go, I'm like, I want to learn more. Once I learned like all the catalog, all the old producers from, you know, jazz, funk and soul and hip hop, then I'm like, the rest of the world is, there's like endless possibilities of where music comes from and what's going on. So I started like venturing out there.
In terms of your creative process as well, you in two different interviews, I saw you talk about creating music that lasts a lifetime, like really timeless pieces of art. Mm-hmm. And the question that I had when I saw you say that was like, how do you do that? How can you even anticipate that a piece of music is going to be timeless? Is there something in the design of it or the inspiration or the story?
There's a few times I've been in the studio and I'm like, a song I might be working on gives me goosebumps. You know, that happens. It was like when I did we did Justin Bieber's Where Are You Now, like something like that. Like just was like, whoa, what the hell are we doing? And then like Lean On for Major Lazer, that was a record that I've probably spent 1 year on the production, you know, because I did so many different versions. Like, no, this isn't right now. This isn't what's happening right now. I need to do something. As a producer, my job is to predict the future. Like when I release this record, after I make it, it's going to take like 3 months to actually get to the people, you know, because it's like you needed to go with labels, clearing the record. It can't just be like, back in the day, I would make an edit and DJ it and it was like hitting people right up my little local neighborhood. But a producer's job is literally like try to like, at least mine, my forte has always been like, how can I do something that's going to be big in like 6 months or like a year, like kind of like being futuristic sounding, because that's what the greats have always done, you know, Prince or Timberland or Pharrell, they've always made records that trend set because they were so futuristic. So my goal has always been to follow them, never to follow a trend. And those two records were ones that we did and we're like, yes, this is going to work, even though it's fucking crazy. Or even Pawn the Floor, I remember listening to that and driving around in the car. That was a song I did for Major Lazer. I remember driving around to LA and looking at the guy who produced me named Switch, and we were just like, is this going to work? It was so crazy. Like, we were just like, this is so wild. And then, yeah, like 4 years later, Beyonce sampled that record and it became a massive hit. So there was like, my career's always had these little moments where we do things and then the ramifications happen later. You know, you feel the effects, you know, the seeds, like you said. But yeah, having classics is important. And I think a couple of times, you know, when you're in it and you're like, okay, this is worth the time. This is worth the effort, because learning songwriting with some of the great guys like, you know, Dr. Luke Sama Publishing in the beginning, and having to be in the studio with him and Circuit and a lot of his writers, I was like, man, you've spent 3 days on like a second verse. Like, this is what you do now. That's what pop music is. Like, you literally, like, if you think a record is the big record, it's so painstakingly, like the effort is so concise, like how to make this the best record ever. Like everything is like a perfect addition, like an architect. You're like, every little corner of the house has got to be perfect, right? So I learned that process, which I don't do very often, but when a record's big, I follow through. And then otherwise, just do a shit ton of records and one of them is going to be good too. That's another process you can do, which also I can do that too. Like, just put, you know, randomly I put records out, and a record like On My Mind, which is another house record on my album, that was a huge TikTok record, which we would never guess. Like, you can't even guess when those records happen.
So because you can't guess when one's going to be a winner and maybe one's not going to catch on, as a creative, do you kind of try and not harm your piece by trying to predict too much what the outcome's going to be? Do you just focus on the process itself? And like, how much can you predict if something's going to be a...
I mean, there's a lot of like, in this, like, we're talking about being in the studio. So like I said, there's a process like to making a great record, but there's also like diplomacy when you're a producer. Like, you have to know the artist, like, you know, Ed Sheeran, do you have an extra record we can try to work on? And then he gives you songwriting. That's how like a record like Cold Water happened, was another Bieber song I did. And then you're like, okay, can we ask Bieber's manager, can he maybe do this record? We'll do a trade for a production. Then, okay, then that deal's in the place. Then, okay, who can play the guitar on this? Oh, you find that person. So sometimes it's literally like being like an ambassador, like talking to all these people to try to put a record together too. Like, that's another process that I had to learn. And that's something else. Like, when a record's already done, like, you take a song and you dress up the production, you still have to find all the keys to make that record work. So it's like every record is a different journey, you know? And now with dance music, I'm literally just in the studio hearing records and trying to figure out what sound I want to make for a live effect. And then I apply that in the studio. But I've literally probably every kind of songwriting you can do, I've done it, you know, from like sitting with an acoustic guitar with Madonna to, you know, recording sound field recordings in a favela, or, you know, paying for studio session for a reggae artist with like my last little bit of money in Philly. Like, it's at you know, the Root studio and like barely getting a hook, and then it was not even good enough to making something out of that later. You know, like it's always like it could be collections of vocals or sample packs or everything I've done. You know, I've tried it, you know.
What's the cost of all of this in terms of on your, maybe cost is a bit of a presumption, but what's the sacrifice or the cost in terms of like personal life balance? Because you're obsessed. You've been obsessed with
I think I was probably running at like 200 miles an hour until COVID happened. I don't think I would ever take a break. And that was probably the best thing that happened. Like when the lockdown happened and I couldn't do shows, I was like, shit, let me actually buy a house and let me actually like, you know, like figure out what's my next steps in life. Mm. I kind of needed that break because I was just going, everything was breakneck speed, you know? It was like the Grammys this weekend. Oh, you have a session with this person this weekend. Oh, we got to get back on this. I got to go to Jamaica and do this. It's like everything was happening. I never said no to anybody. I was like, this is crazy. I was like, you know, a musician has the same life as an athlete. You have like a peak, you know? If you're a linebacker in NFL football, your career is like maybe 3 or 4 years because you're getting beat up. A quarterback can play for, you know, till he's 44. A producer or artist, like they're just hot for as long as they're hot. And then they have to find, they have to come down. Some of them can just continue to always go there. Like, you know, you have like people that are just always going to be in your mind, like Madonna or, you know, some of the big pop stars like Taylor Swift, every record is going to perform. But a lot of times you like on borrowed time, you don't know when your window is going to close. So for me, I was like, I got to keep going. And I feel like I never had hit my peak. So I was like, let's keep pushing it forward. And eventually I was like, you know what? This isn't that important. Like, let me like actually enjoy my life. I have 3 kids now. I want to like do things. I want to you know, explore more, but not think about the work. I want to do things that maybe benefit my mind. And I think that's kind of what the last 2 years of downtime has given me. Even though I did produce a lot of records in between, it was on my own terms. You know, I wasn't like chasing all the live events, and I wasn't chasing all the different successes I could have had.
COVID was very much the same experience for me. It's actually why I resigned from my company, because I actually got to look at my life. It was like when I stopped flying 8 times a month, I got to look at my life. And I also got to feel what it was like to slow down and talk to my friends and my family a little bit. When you think about your pre-COVID life, now you've got the benefit of hindsight and you've had time to pause. Were you happy in that phase of your life?
I was, because it's weird. I mean, I was losing touch with other people. I felt that. So I was like very insular. But my life, I run the best like when it's chaos, when I'm doing 300 shows a year and I'm like getting up and doing the emails and going to the gym. And then I'm like, this is like, I just work under pressure. I don't know what it is. It's like my best forte is to have just chaotic stuff happening all the time. Mm. And I'm like, somehow I can get through it. So I was into that. And then I was like, this is a very unhealthy way to live. So now it feels like I'm back on a promo tour, and it feels like I'm back on this like fast track. And I'm like, kind of want COVID a little bit, but then, you know, it's all part of the process. Cause if you put a record out, it's important for people to hear it. You know, mm-hmm. like you only have one chance for records to be released. And it's like, you should give that, if you have a great song, you should give it every opportunity it has to reach people, because it's one shot, you know? Mm. But don't waste your time on every song. Like you have a good song. Like I got this song, the song Miguel that we're promoting. I'm like, this song's worth the work, you know? Other songs maybe like, I'll put them out and maybe something will happen. You don't never know. Maybe it's in 3 months, there'll be like a midget dancing to it on TikTok or something. And like, it's a crazy experience or something. Mm-hmm. And it goes viral. You never know what's going to happen. It's like just rolling the dice every time. But every once in a while, there are some steps you can take to ensure a record has its best chance at surviving, you know?
And that's like what you're doing now, right? Yeah. Like the promo, putting effort behind it. So COVID happens, your world kind of grinds to a halt, everybody's does. And you probably find yourself in a house somewhere alone.
Yeah.
How's that then in terms of mental health and dealing with the sudden stop?
I think the thing that sucked the worst about COVID is I had these children, and like, it was a time I was like, man, I can do whatever I want, but there was nothing to do. Like you couldn't go to, in LA, we closed the parks for so long. We closed, like there was no school, like, you know, there's no birthday parties. You can't go see other kids. Like it was just kind of like, it's almost like a waste opportunity. I had like a whole year to be with my kids. And I was like, what do we even find time to do? I was like, I buy a house, basketball courts in the house, just play basketball. Like it was like literally I made an environment for them to enjoy life. But I think, honestly, I've been doing this for so long and I've made a really great team around me. Like I have these great women that like are always work with me and like work for me. And I think it just feels like there's a big family, like, now, you know, like, people, like, it's a team, whether it's like on my management side or just like my personal side. It's like I have a people that are always looking in my best interests. And I think I got lucky. I've been doing that since day one. Like, my first manager worked for me for free for the first year because he just like believed in what I did. And I was like, I don't need a manager. I was making so much money before I paid taxes, like just selling mixtapes and DJing. Like, I was like, I bought a property in Philadelphia, like, in my first year of like learning how to hustle the system of being a DJ. And then I was like, damn, but there's more to be done, though. Like, he's like, there's more you can do than just living in Philly and like being the biggest DJ here. And I think he gave me that motivation to like be bigger. And from him, I, you know, another management group happened. And then I've had a lucky journey. I've been the same with the same team for, you know, 20 years.
Wow.
A lot of people don't get that. But I also think I was very visionary in what I want to do. So if you're like a young person and like you get sucked up by management or whatever, they might have a vision for you, or they might not, or they might not have the right vision for you, or they might not give you the room to be yourself. Then you're going to switch like 40 managers and you might not ever find, you know, the success you need. So it's important to find people, you know, that really believe in you, but also let you be yourself, because you got to find that, because you're going to be, that's all you got at the end of the day. You can lose a million managers and a million people, but you can always start over and just be you.
Reminded me of the Avicii documentary that I saw, which was a real pivotal moment in my life. Because I spent 4 weeks at home in 2019 and I was very much being dragged around. We had 1,000 employees, so I was being dragged around the place. And that documentary taught me the importance of saying no to stuff.
100%. Like, Avicii, I feel like I never, he was probably like one of my biggest influences, even though he was younger than me. I remember hanging out with him a couple of times. I was just like, man, this guy's a genius, but like, he doesn't feel like he's in his own skin, you know, because I don't think he ever had that chance to be who he what he wanted to be. He was like, he was almost like became like a machine, because his success happened so quick. But that happens a lot. That's like the one story in the DJ world, but in the pop world, it happens like way too much, I think.
Are you good at saying no to stuff?
No, I say yes to everything, but I'm also like, I have really thick skin. I feel like my personality is enormous. I can also like, I can find my way through things. I always say yes, and then I'll say no for the next time if it sucks. But
yeah.
I've done everything, you know, and I'm like, you know, this isn't the right thing. I move on. Or even if it's a studio session, I might go get breakfast and I might never come back. You know, whatever it is, I'll give everything a chance, you know. But I know now some things, you know, my management knows me now to where some things don't even get to me. The questions don't even come, because they know it's like a no. Or they know I'll say yes and it'll be a bad yes.
Thick skin. You started talking a lot about mental health over the last couple of years, your partnership with Calm as well. I was reading about mental health in the DJing world, but mental health amongst men anyway. What's your journey been with your own mental health?
I think, you know, just being put as like, you know, whatever celebrity or whatever it is, being attention always on you, is you're going to have so many critics and you're going to have so many, you know, the love is cool, but nobody really cares about like all the adoration you get. You care about the people that don't like you. And that you get caught up in that, even if it's only like 5%, but they really want to be vocal about they don't like you or they don't love you. That bothers you, no matter who you are. You know, eventually I had to just like, wow, these people suck. Like, just whatever. You're never gonna get away from the people that like want to always be critics. You know, they just want to get a rise out of you. I think eventually you just got to say, fuck it. The people that are around me, their opinion's what matters. Like, the people that I trust, and you can't like kind of sit in the opinion of people that don't know you, or maybe build an opinion about you from, you know, whatever it is. Cause when it comes to social media, it's like a game, you know. It's not like look, I was talking about Conor McGregor earlier today. I'm like, he's like the biggest heel, most paid athlete last year, even though he didn't fight, because he's like, people love to hate him, you know? So he built a brand out of just being that person. But then you got to take the good and the bad with it. I mean, if you want to be in this business, which is like, I guess, showbiz, like you said, the comedians, the DJs, I'm like kind of like a popular DJ. I'm more like people might go to my shows and not even know my music because they know my brand.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of sucks, because they don't know what they're going to get. But because I'm on that pedestal, you're just going to get eyes on you for everything. So I feel like you just have to, if you want the success, if you want to be at this level, you got to like just take it. And if I didn't want it, I would just back up, you know, but I can take it. So I feel like it's something that I had to learn to grow into myself and just be like, okay, be comfortable. Cause what really matters is my team, you know, what my family thinks about me, what my team thinks about me. And I think those people will give you that motivation to go every day.
Have you made a conscious effort to like shorten that circle by like logging off. I read somewhere that someone else has your Twitter password now and you don't really yeah. have it. And have you made a conscious effort?
Yeah, I haven't been on Twitter in like 5 years, but I think, yeah, it kind of sucks. I hit or miss. Cause I mean, even TikTok, I was like slow to do that. But then, like I said, if you want your brand to exist, it's gotta be there. Like, cause that's like, you know, there's more eyeballs on TikTok than there are on YouTube nowadays. So you have to be part of that conversation with the audience. It took me a while. Like I had to find people that actually could help me run that because I couldn't do it myself and I couldn't be, you know, in the, every day long, like videotaping and doing dances or whatever. So I had to find different ways to make those things work for myself. It wasn't easy in the beginning, but yeah, I don't stay on the social too much. But then of course, during this album cycle, I'm on there and I'm like having to always participate. But, you know, luckily I think I've got great fans. I've got great people, great response to my album. It wasn't that difficult, but every once in a while you have to take your mind off it because you can get caught up, you know?
What made you start talking about mental health and being a bit of an advocate for that? You said that a lot of people should speak about it a lot more. Where did that inspiration come from?
I think probably after the Avicii situation. And then, you know, I work with a lot of rappers. I think I had a hip hop album that came out like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago. It's called California. And I had Lil Xan and I had Lil Peep on it. And I had Trippie Redd and I was working with XXXTentacion. I just remember I did this whole circuit working with all these young rappers and they were like really young. They were like 19, 20. And the studio sessions were so weird and crazy. And then these rappers all started to die. Like they all started like, you know, Lil Peep overdosed on opiates and, you know, X was shot. But he also had such a crazy vision on life and experiences. And he was like, went through so much. And I saw what was happening to these young guys because they were getting so popular so quick. And I was really, I just like, damn, these guys all need like a big brother. So I think just with those guys, a lot of them, I was helping them out, making decisions, but just seeing how crazy it is to be a 20-year-old right now is much more difficult than when I was there. You know, when I was there, you literally had your group of friends and that's all you knew, the people on your street. Now everybody knows who you are or can know you who you are or have some kind of opinion about you. And I think you have to find ways to, like I said earlier, block that out and just concentrate on like being the best you, which just sounds like a cliche, but you really have to compete with just yourself every day, not everybody else.
One of the things that I saw in that Avicii doc as well was he was suffering with pretty severe anxiety. I remember the scenes of him being in that hotel room and his manager saying, "We got to go." Mm-hmm. And him saying, I'm not going.
Yeah.
Have you ever felt that anxiety? Have you ever felt that kind of crippling?
No, I think, you know, I've deal like people like close to my life have anxiety and they have attacks a lot and I have to talk them down sometimes. So I know how it feels. And that's just like in the day-to-day life. Me, I feel like I still like the stage. I've never been, and I've also, like I said, I've also made a concerted effort to make the team like make me comfortable, you know? That Avicii documentary, I'm not gonna talk about like the people on the team, but like they just didn't care. Like no one cared about him or what he was feeling. I remember being at shows and I was like, he played before me in Vegas and he would be just missing. He would play like 2 hours later and he would have to get fucked up to get on stage because he just couldn't do it. He couldn't be up there. He couldn't be on a pedestal. And I can feel that way sometimes. Like on this tour, you know, just jet lag alone, you're like you're like nodding out at dinner and you're like, oh, I gotta go be excited for this crowd. And I'm really good at like making that work for myself now. So these people I owe them this experience. But yes, I take a lot more time for myself now. Like I'm like, I don't need to do these anymore. I'm telling them like, this is over for me. This is like something I would do 3 years ago. It's important to take that away, that out of the equation. I'll feel a lot better. But yeah, you gotta make those personal choices. And you gotta, like I said, people that are hungry like me and you, that when they get on the train, they're just like going full throttle. You do need something to say like, okay, it's okay to like not go 100 miles an hour all the time. You can like go like at a strolling pace or something.
And I guess for you, from what I read, a lot of that was your kids as well, right?
Yeah.
When your first child was born, you talked about that being a really pivotal moment. It taught you that the value of time. And
I think my first kid, when I had my first son, Lockett, I was like, I actually went faster. So I was like, I did. I was like, also as a father, your kids, I was like, I found a connection with my sons when they were like 5 and 4 years old when they were like, because really the mother's like everything. They're not leaving her sight. They're not around. They don't really give a shit about like their fathers. I felt like that in the beginning of my son. But so I was like, I got a kid now. My life's about to get really complicated. And I think all my best work happened around them because you said time management. I was like, okay, I have like Saturday, Sunday, or I have like Wednesday off, I'm going to go to the studio for 16 hours every other day because I don't want to do anything else. This is the time I have. Like those 5 years, I did all of my biggest records. And my next son was born and my time got even crazier. And then you just kind of like I said, you got to manage time better each time. Like you got to figure out how to make it work. I'm still figuring it out, you know? Now my boys are entering like the teenage years, like they're 11, 7. So they're asking me questions now that they never would before. Like I'm like having to give them like, you know, boy and man advice, which I was like, this is cool. And I'm having conversations that I can relate to them as much as they can relate to me. Before it was like with just Baby Shark and Legos and stuff.
When you talking about your three boys, when you did this really sweet post giving a bit of a shout out to their mothers. And in that sentence, you said, I'm still a work in progress. And I was really intrigued by that. Why did you say I'm still a work in progress as it relates to a post about the mothers and your boys?
I think because, you know, my boys, I want them to I want them, like I want to instill them the same discipline that my father has given me. You know, which I don't know how to do that. Like, I don't think my father knew either. Like, I remember going to my father's rooms and he had like books about like being the best dad. You know, like, I remember like, I was like, I didn't think that about until I was later. I'm like, damn, maybe I should check that book out. You know, like, I'm like, it seemed silly when I was younger, but I think being the person I am, I'm also like this, like I said, my personality is so big that I feel like I'm kind of alpha even for my children. Like, I'm like, when I'm off break, I'm like, let's go snowboarding. Let's go to the basketball court. And they're just like, dad, relax, like we want to watch TV or something, you know. I'm like, I'm just like, why don't they want to do all this stuff with me? Like, I don't know. I'm like, they think I'm like the crazy person that comes over and like takes them away to do crazy stuff all the time. And it's like, it's a big distraction in their life a lot of times. So I've got to figure out how to like be with them, you know, more than just be their insane sports dad. I got to like be their friend too. So that's like what I'm talking about. Things like that, when you know, just even like sitting with my son, my 7-year-old, and like watching cartoons or watching him play Minecraft on his iPad is so much more important than him. If I do that for an hour, then like take him on like a trip to Nepal or something, which I've done, you know, like it's like, they're like, they remember that, but they actually remember this time and on the couch with me a lot more, I feel like.
You are always one decision away from taking your business to the next level. And a decision that's helped me to transform my business is moving over to NetSuite, who I'm excited to say are a sponsor of this podcast. If you don't know already, NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. It's reduced IT costs because it lives in the cloud, so you can access it from anywhere. And the cost of managing and running multiple systems because it's in one unified business management suite. My team and I don't have to worry about tasks being manual and clunky, and it means that I can be more efficient and to focus on more important things like bringing you the best episodes and guests on this show. So I become one of the 37,000 companies that have already made the move over to NetSuite. NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks, so head to netsuite.com/Bartlett for a free product tour. Back to the episode. The other thing that we were talking about just then is this, it just came to mind, is when I had Olympians on this podcast, they talked to me about this thing called gold medal depression. And Israel Adesanya came here, the UFC champion, 2 weeks ago. And he said that the worst day of his life was the day after he won
the belt. Yeah.
He said he went straight into therapy. And I saw a similar tone and a similar narrative when you spoke about, in fact, some of the worst days are the day after the high.
Yeah.
And then you actually said that you have to kind of suppress the high
100%.
To avoid the low.
Yeah, always. Because I feel like it gets addicting. Because I mean, like Israel, he does like what, like 2 big fights a year.
Yeah,
like I'm like doing like, which is, I'm not knocking him because he's the fucking amazing. But I have to do like 250 like shows, you know, like sometimes. And every night might be bigger. Some nights might be lame. You got to just take it in stride. Every once in a while, I'm like, damn, that was awesome. And I'm like, appreciate the, like, you have to have gratitude for that. But I mean, if it's going to be your lifestyle every night, people are always like, you don't drink when you're DJing. I'm like, I'm DJing like 200 nights a year. I can't be drunk. I'll be dead. Like, it's like, I don't know. It's like, not even, why are you even asking that question? It's like, this is still a job for me. I found ways to like have energy and like have this feeling. And like, it's actually, I think it's mental work to do that. But you always, if you're just going to be like in these peaks and valleys all the time, that's not healthy. And I see a lot of people that are other creators, and it's crazy, but like the best creators are really like have bipolar tendencies. I've noticed that. Like some of my favorite people I collaborate with, I've noticed they have, and some of them aren't addressing it. And it's like, it leads to their failures in some parts. Like I always see, like, I think my the most creative people like have are always dealing with that, you know, whether it was Bowie or other DJs. Like I see that a lot in my peers, and I think it's important to, because they love that high too. They're chasing that high of like that experience, you know. Mm. It's just like a drug, like having like fans, you know, scream being at a festival. But eventually you just kind of like drown out the noise and just figure out, just it's make it more of a job, because you can't just live like every night's like the biggest party of your life, you know, because then it will be, there's going to be a big downer.
And you've changed yourself. You said you've trained yourself to be like present and energetic without letting the adrenaline fill your body, yeah, and then staying up till 7 a.m.
Because also, yeah, it's hard to sleep. You know, like when you do a show, like I'm leaving Vegas, I'm doing like, it's a great party. We like do 1 to 3 a.m. and I'm like, have a little vibe after the show. And then it's like, damn, I got to go to bed. I got to be up at 9 and take my kids. I'm like, how do you like wind down? Because that's really hard to do too.
I had the tiniest dose of this. We took this podcast, we made it a musical, and we did 3 nights at the Palladium. And then, so I started going to sleep at 7 a.m. So I'd come off stage at the Palladium, maybe midnight, come back here, and I'd sit here at the table just like.
It's impossible. That's why I'm not even touching this coffee. Yeah. I don't want to like, I'm like, you know. You don't
want the, yeah.
So you have to literally, I think you have to take in strides, you know, because there's always going to be, I think deep down inside of me, if I like lose all of the, if I, label dropped me, I couldn't make music anymore. Mm. I'm not DJing. I don't really, you know, like I flopped so hard. I feel like I can start over again. That's like something I feel inside me. Okay, maybe I'm gonna be like, I love furniture. Maybe I'll be a carpenter. Whatever it is. Mm. That's just the thing I'm saying. I just feel like, I feel like, or a pizza maker, whatever it is. I always feel like if you have that feeling inside you that you can lose everything and be okay with it, that's, maybe that's the key to success. Then you know it's, all this is just like a facade. Like it's really like, I'll be comfortable as long as I get to do something I love again. Mm. It doesn't have to be huge. I don't be rich, but I feel like any moment if I got taken away, I have my family, I have my kids, and I'll gladly go and do something with them and live a humble life. I always feel like I'm ready for that, you know.
And your new album, this is what, 20 years into your career now, and it's your second full length album since like Florida.
Yeah, that happened because once I started going to the studio in LA, I was like this. You don't make solo albums like Florida. You make albums for other people. You know, I'm just a DJ. I'm like a brand. This brand is limited to a level. But if I work on Britney Spears' album, ooh, I can make this much money, or I can make a hit that streams like this, or if I do this album. And it wasn't until I think we did Major Lazer, I was like, okay, well, at least I can own this project also and make the same size records and take all of it. You know, that became kind of like just the business side of it. I was like, this is a lot better, you know, now. And this, I think finally Diplo is the point where like, okay, I have no other brands to put it in. Mm. This is gonna be my records now. Kind of like, that's kind of how this album happened. Because it's a dance album, but I worked on it as a songwriter, you know, because you hear the songs, they got verse, chorus, verse. They're not straight techno records. They're not straight acid records. They're just like, they're kind of built like pop records.
20 years in, releasing this album, what are you sick of in the process, in the industry? What are you just like, I hate this shit?
I think going through Heathrow's, like the liquids, come on. Like, what is up with that? If I could not travel ever again, that was, I mean, I literally had to spend like 30 minutes there yesterday because like, I was like, they were looking for this one tiny eye cream that was in the bottom of a freaking, I was like, bro, you can have all this stuff. Just take it. Take it away from me. But the travel is the worst. You know, I wish I could teleport to each show, but it's probably the worst thing. If I could just sit home. I also got a really nice house now in Malibu, so I'm like, don't want to go on tour anymore. I kind of want to sit there. I love the, when it was on Twitch, I was DJing this thing. I just didn't make any money. It's cool. I haven't been to Europe in 3 years, so it's, you know, it's actually feels brand new to me. In this line of work, the whole audience changes like every 3 years too. Mm. Like kids that were ravers and go to clubs, when they're 24, when they're 27, they've got full-time jobs and their little cousins have been. I've done like 7 of those generations, I feel like, and they're still coming out and seeing me play. So I've been really lucky.
Based on the life you've lived, when your three boys get to, you know, 16, 18 years old and they come to you and say, Dad, I need advice on like what I should pursue. How do I become sick?
Yeah.
What is the general advice? Is there anything that stands out to you, or is it just?
Man, I would take them on the road with me, I guess. That's the only thing I can do. That's the best advice I can give them. Be like, this is what I do every day, just so you know. You think I'm like doing some crazy shit. I actually have to wake up, go to the gym, and I have to go. We're doing some press and promo. And I have to get ready for the show. We're going to do dinner with the promoter as a nice favor, and we're going to go to the concert. Oh, there's an appearance afterwards. This is what I do. And I go back in the morning. I'm going to the studio first thing in the morning just to show them what it takes. Like, and this is like, you know, 10 years in, just to let them know it's what the process is like. That's the best I can do. I can actually show them that. You know, a lot of kids wouldn't have that, wouldn't have their parents to give them something like that. But yeah, that's what I trained with George Foreman Jr. He's a boxing trainer, and his father, he said that he didn't really understand anything about life till his father took him on the road to see him fight and took him to like the gym sessions and how much work he did. Mm-hmm. And I was in the middle of like George's like the griddle he was doing, the Foreman grill era. Mm-hmm. And he said it just like something clicked changed inside of him. Life. Yeah, changed him inside.
Why the gym? You've mentioned that twice. Is that because?
Oh, because I think I actually every day I have to go to the gym. It's like the one thing that I have to do to like make me feel like normal, because the jet lag for one, but then I also traveling. And then I think I need like an hour. If it's yoga, if it's something, I just need like to sweat for an hour every day to feel normal. I don't know what it is, but it's been like that for like the last 10 years. It's not a very healthy lifestyle. I mean, I don't drink very often, but this COVID got me into drinking again because it was a little bit boring to go to eat dinner every night. So I think I'm trying to reset that a little bit.
When someone's obsessive and they achieve success and they're flying 300, but they have 300 shows a year, it's an inconceivable number in my mind. Their relationships, in terms of their romantic relationships, like how on earth does one maintain good romantic relationships when they're that obsessed?
It's been hard. I had a girlfriend during the COVID times and she was like great energy. She understood my life. Really, you have to understand your lifestyle because it's so fast paced. Also, you're going to be, it's about you. It's like, you're the artist, right? It's like, and when I was dating people that were in the music industry in the beginning, I didn't understand at all, like that they're two different people. One's the person that I know. And then one's the artist, you know, because that's a whole facade. Like you go and see them on stage, you go see them do this. It's not the person that you see in the bedroom at the end of the night or whatever. It's different. And I couldn't figure that out as a young person. Like, and that's why I don't think it's probably not that healthy to date someone else that's also in the music business, because it's like really, it's like smoke and mirrors a lot between what they're doing, what their shows are like, and who they are as a person and who they are as like an artist is different.
Do you value that? Do you value romantic connection? Is it a big priority?
Yeah, I do. I have two mothers of my children, and like finding the balance with them has been like the hardest thing, but it's like so great now. It's like so peaceful. Like everybody loves each other, and like my kids are all happy and the mothers are happy and everybody's healthy. That was been and then you know, if I have a new girlfriend, I brought her into the mix and they liked her too. It was like, so I've like found this kind of harmony in it, you know. But there's always turbulence, you know. We're having a fight now, like with school. My son goes to high school, so I have to like navigate that problem. There's like new problems all the time, you know. You're never going to figure everything out.
Are you difficult to be in a relationship with?
I think no, because I'm literally like I'm along for the ride. I'm like whatever. But then of course I have these kind of Scorpio tendencies. I have like zero emotions, so like it's hard to really
zero emotions.
Yeah, there's like nothing. You're going to get nothing from me most of the time. Really? Like, yeah. So a lot of girls, but if you spend enough time with me, you know the real me. But I think it takes a while.
You're going to get nothing from me most of the time in terms of emotions.
Yeah, I'm really emotionless. Emotionlessness. I feel like I don't show a lot of emotion. You know, I'm kind of like, I think maybe this is what I got from my dad. I'm just like an army guy. You know, I'm like out here just like saving face, like poker face. I'm always like, it's hard to get through my exterior.
Is that a good thing, do you think, for like in terms of mental health?
It's just, yeah, I mean, I found people that could deal with it, you know. Probably not a good thing, no. But it's been like that. I think that's also the thing you have to put on to be, like I said, be in this world too. Like to like, it's definitely something to protect me. But at the same time, you know, if you get the right person, you give her everything.
I sat here with Patrice Evra. You're a football fan. You're an Arsenal fan, right? So Patrice Evra was the famous Manchester United left back. And he said something similar to me. He said he grew up on the streets of France, drug dealing. He watched his brothers in his house die from drug overdoses in the bathroom. And then his head teacher at the time, like, sexually molested him. So he put up this, and to survive on the streets of France at the time, he put up this big kind of external outer wall, tough skin, as you might have called it. And that served him to becoming an elite athlete. It served him to a point. And then one day his girl turned to him on the sofa and said, "Are you happy?" And he was like, fired back up. "Yeah, I'm happy." But then she kept persisting, right? Like angrily, right? That defense. And then she kept persisting. And he just broke down. And he'd never told anybody what had happened to him with his headmaster. And he told her at like 35 years old. And he said to me while he was sat here, that journey of like opening up and not being the tough guy anymore actually changed his life. It changed his relationship with his kids. It meant that he finally talked about how he felt for the first time, even though it made him feel vulnerable. And that's why I asked the question, is it a good thing like to be...
You know, I think I'm very selfish because at the end of the day, I'm never lonely on the road. And I think it's because... I've never fell in love with a girl. Like I never felt like, this is love. Cause if it was love, it's love. Like the love is like love. Like I had my heart broken. Maybe I was in love a little bit, but like, I never felt like life-changing love until my son was born. And then I was like that, the love I have with my firstborn son out and then my second, my third, it's like the connection though. I'm like, damn, no matter what, this kid stuck with me. Like, this is like my life partner for real. Like, this is like somebody that I have to make this person a better human. Like that was something that when that happened, it became like my go-to. Like I'm always gonna, this is the person that I care the most about, all three of these boys. It really, that was the first time I understood love, was when I had children, you know? And maybe that sounds weird to you, but it just feels like that's undeniable. Like no matter what they do, I'm gonna love them, like, you know?
Do you believe in love romantically?
Maybe not, maybe I don't have it. I mean, I'm still like playing the game. Like I'm still, trying to find a great woman to settle down with.
Our previous guests always write a question for the next guest. And then, funnily enough, I never tell the guest who the previous person was. He wrote a question for you, didn't know who he was writing it for. He wrote, why do you exist?
Maybe it is to bring joy and inspiration to people. And maybe, maybe new music and exploration into culture, I hope. And then in like a more spiritual way, it is to just add something to the world that wasn't there before, because everything you create in the fabric of time and space is something that's brand new. And that's only what we add. So those are three answers.
Amen. Thank you so much. And thank you for coming here. Your new album, Diplo, which me and my girlfriend sat on this table a couple of days ago listening to. It's remarkable that someone 20 years into their career can create a project that feels so fresh and relevant and exciting at the same time. I honestly played the record for my girlfriend. We were going through the record.
Did you guys do a podcast?
No, we were eating dinner here. We were eating dinner here. And I was like, Diplo's coming in. And so I started playing the new records in the album. And she's from France and Portugal. She lives in Indonesia. She goes, I know that one. She goes, I know that one.
Oh.
Because a lot of the
singles, raver.
And I literally had to check the year in which the album had dropped, because the songs felt so familiar, and that really took me off guard. But
I'll be honest, we added a couple of tracks that were already out.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah, yeah. I could see from the view numbers.
I think the streams go up first week a little bit, but they're part of the project. I mean, I got really lucky here in the UK. I had this song with Paul Wolford called "Looking for Me" that was like so big here. I was so it was like my biggest solo record I've ever had in anywhere was like number one in Ireland. I think it was number two here. But I feel like the UK really, if anything, the dance culture, they understand it. Like they get it. It's been a while. You guys have like real dance projects, like, you know, Chemical Brothers, Chase the Status, Bicep, Disclosure. You have like the idea of like dance projects, which we don't have in America. We just have like a bunch of like scummy DJs going out every night and playing in Las Vegas. But we're trying to build it. I think it's important, but here you guys have this culture. It's amazing.
Well, thank you for blessing us with another project. And it's legendary that it's so resonant 20 years into your career.
Yeah.
So it's really, really inspiring. Thank you for being
here. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Huge pleasure. Thank you. One decision away from taking your business to the next level. And a decision that's helped me to transform my business is moving over to NetSuite, who I'm excited to say are a sponsor of this podcast. If you don't know already, NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. It's reduced IT costs because it lives in the cloud, so you can access it from anywhere. And the cost of managing and running multiple systems, because it's in one unified business management suite. My team and I don't have to worry about tasks being manual and clunky, and it means that I can be more efficient and to focus on more important things like bringing you the best episodes and guests on this show. So I become one of the 37,000 companies that have already made the move over to NetSuite. NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks, so head to netsuite.com/Bartlett for a free product tour. Back to the episode.